Okay, next up is Dr. Greg Clark. Most of you are probably familiar with Dr. Clark's early work, which focused on the development and testing of the coping with depression intervention for depressed adolescents. And he played a real central role in some of the first studies that systematically examined the potential utility of booster sessions or continuation treatment for youth depression and for any disorder with that matter among youth. And also it's noteworthy that he conducted some of the earliest work on preventive interventions for youth with depression or for youth with any internalizing disorder. More recently, his work is focused more broadly on effectiveness of mental health interventions in various practice settings, with an emphasis on using health services data to inform intervention adaptations. This work has really thoughtfully incorporated collaborations with clinical epidemiologists, mental health economists, and others, particularly health services researchers, and the program of intervention research has been expanded recently to include trials that involve alternative service delivery models like collaborative care models and primary care and quality improvement kinds of efforts. So, therefore, I think his work is a real exemplar of translational interdisciplinary effectiveness research. So, Dr. Clark?
Well, let's see. I'm going to page down here. When Joel asked me to come and make his presentation, I had the full intention of sort of trying to weave my research into the kind of the assigned topic and how one might, at the beginning of a career, you know, plan to conduct research and some of the pithy kinds of recommendations. And I have to admit, I didn't do it quite as well. I kind of focused on a number of other more process issues. I didn't bring up a lot of my own research or slides here. So if things occur to me as we're going through, I'll kind of mention them. But what did occur to me, though, was some of the things that I have kind of, in retrospect, looking back on my career, have maybe some special insights into and some things I think that may be coming up and impacting you during the upcoming next decade at least. Some of them you may have already heard about. Take my own particular take on, like the roadmap, the NIH roadmap. And these are the three kinds of topics I thought might be addressable in the short amount of time we have. First, a little bit of an overview of a non-university research career, which is where I find myself over the last 10 years, after having been in a medical school for 10 years in the Department of Psychiatry, which is, I think I glanced through the list of attendees, and there are a few people out there in the audience, I don't know, maybe they went to the other room, maybe they're here, who it seems are at another place, a non-university setting, but I thought I would, for those of you that most of you are at universities, but you may either find the opportunity to work with colleagues in these kinds of settings, or you may at some point even consider moving into those kind of settings yourself. And particularly coming from an academic setting, a university, I didn't know much about what it was like and what some of the conditions were and how it might have differed. And there are some strengths and some weaknesses to it, so I'll cover those. Also, sort of research networks and the role they're going to be playing, I think, increasingly in multi-site, large clinical trials. And then the impacts of the NIH roadmap continuum, especially on those of us, I think, and all of us are, somewhat more living in a silo of a certain kind of research, and the demands that have become more explicit at NIH and NIMH about stretching yourself beyond your comfort zone. So, talk about each of those. Very briefly, I'm a clinical psychologist. I trained at the University of Oregon. I actually particularly sought out Pete Lewinson. I don't know if many of you know his work, one of the psychologists who did a lot of work with adult depression and later with some with adolescent depression. He was my major professor during training and then and now also a colleague on other studies as I moved into my first positions, independent research positions, which was at the Oregon Health Sciences University. That's a medical school in Portland, Oregon, and I was an associate professor there when I left in the child psychiatry division. Was one of the, I was the only psychologist in the division of psychiatrists, which mostly it was good. A couple of things, at least they were sometimes confused about what I could offer. And then I moved from there across the river to Kaiser Permanente's Center for Health Research, which is a freestanding research center in combination. Do most of you know who Kaiser is? I know that it's got presence here in the Washington area, but from around the country. It's the largest HMO in the nation, a nonprofit HMO. I should make that point, because there are some differences between for-profit and nonprofit ones. And I've been there ever since 1996, and in addition to being what we call a senior investigator, which I guess is sort of roughly equivalent to a professor, I'm also one of the associate program directors in terms of supervising a number of early and mid and late career investigators as well. And across all of that time, as Joel's mentioned, my focus has been on youth depression treatment and prevention, and more recently looking at, if you want to call it, dose ranging is one of the ways I see it, and also sort of setting ranging in terms of the questions that some of the early research I did, the Coping with Depression course, some of you may be familiar with that, it was a pretty big intensive intervention, even though it was group therapy and therefore intrinsically a little more cost effective than individual therapy. It was still 32 hours of therapy time, and it had a very intensive supervisory and, you know, kind of structure. And clearly a modality and an intensity that was not one that could really be adopted in many settings. And increasingly, as probably most of you probably know, the unfortunate trends in the funding for pediatric mental health have been in the direction of fewer and fewer dollars out of the healthcare, out of an increasing pie of healthcare dollars, a smaller and smaller slice, both in terms of percentage, in terms of real dollars as well. So although I think advocacy and policymakers should consider reversing that trend, it's also true that when you go to a lot of these settings, whether they be schools or healthcare settings or safety net clinics, they're all struggling with the fact of trying to expand the deliverable products to the kinds of kids and families who have concerns, but also doing it in a realistic way on a small penny per dollar segment of the healthcare dollar that's out there. So that has motivated us to look at other modalities for delivering services. Now let's go back to the first of those non-university research careers. Private research centers, and there are some examples down there, Rand Corporation in Santa Monica, but they've also got a Washington branch as well, and I think one in Pittsburgh, Oregon Research Institute, Research Triangle Institute, Oregon Social Learning Center in our own place, and there are many, many others, but these are just a few that I know and collaborate with people in some of these settings. They are emerging more often as alternatives to universities in terms of being academic or full-time research centers. And most of them, the ones I've listed here, virtually all of the work they do is public domain research and publication. That is, there are some private places that will do proprietary research where they only do the work for the agency or the entity and don't release it and publish it. But I would say 99.9% of the research we do is non-proprietary, even though in some cases it has been not very flattering to the health plan. Just a quick comparison of what it's like to work, because I have been, I spent 10 years now in both settings, actually 11 years as a university associate professor. I would say one of the hardest things for me to leave when I considered moving from the medical school to the center was that it just is intrinsically, I think, more prestigious to have a professor role. On the other hand, it's often quite substantially better paying, I think, for the equivalent positions, maybe not some of the very top flight university, you know, tenured professors maybe in an endowed chair, but I think certainly for entry-level positions, it typically the salaries do tend to be a bit higher, perhaps in compensation. One of the other things, and I think each of you has to sort of, you know, pick your passion. I think there are people who enjoy the mix of teaching and research, and I think a university setting is quite good for offering you that, demanding that actually in most cases. Whereas in research centers, it's research 100% full time. I should also point out that one of the things I see as the benefit of that is that all of the support structure is entirely dedicated to research as well. Whereas a lot of my colleagues in universities, very often the finance department understands the finance and billing systems for the care delivery system or for the medical system, but they don't understand very often how to prepare research budgets, and it's often left up to the research investigators or team to prepare their own budgets, where it's typically we have a whole finance department that prepares our budgets for us. I'm going to skip through a couple of these things here. Some of the other ones that have been very interesting for me over the time is that we have when I was in the university, the medical school, we tended to have our own silos of research staff, many of which were students, graduate students, and so on, who routinely migrated out graduated on and went on to research careers of their own, which is a great thing, but it meant that you were constantly having to retrain people. Whereas we're dealing with people who've been 20, 30, 35 years, 40 years working in very similar kinds of roles, have an enormous amount of accumulated experience, and don't have to reinvent the wheel each time they go ahead and do things. And so there's a continuity there, which also tends to be higher paying staff as well, because they're a lot further along in their careers. So that's both a downside and a positive aspect to working in these kind of centers. One of the greatest things I can say is that our medical setting has what's called an electronic medical record, which means that every medical encounter, all of the encounters and data is charted, so there's up to 20 diagnoses, up to 20 procedure codes, all medical tests and so on are all in there, and searchable clinical notes. Won't bore you with the rest, but we have some what are called health informatics colleagues about searching the free text narrative for key phrases and terms to try to classify what's going on in those encounters, which makes it a very, very rich environment for finding individuals, for being able to describe who your recruitment pool is, and the people you didn't get, as well as the people you did get to enroll in the study, and say a little bit more about generalization. The other nice thing there is that most of you, and I think, and I, when I was at the medical school, are in a single department, which is mental health researchers. And there's something to be said for having that breadth of the depth of colleagues who can talk about sort of subtleties within your profession. Whereas in my case, although there are a couple of other psychologists there, right down the hall from me is a pharmacist researcher, another economist, a sociologist, an anthropologist, medical anthropology generally, and so there's a great deal of breadth of colleagues. And not only is one of the interesting things is having been 10 or 15 years out of a graduate program, I feel like I'm getting a full-time postdoc all the time, because I'm often included as the only mental health member of a team which includes physicians and economists and sociologists, and so I'm learning about their particular kinds of professions, and it's really had a big influence on the kinds of work I do, not only in terms of the content areas, do work in diabetes, cancer, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and so on, but also in terms of the methodologies and the perspectives employed, particularly the economists, I would say, have gotten me much more interested in the issues of policy and adoption of innovations and the progression of innovations through medical systems and so on that I would have never had as a perspective before going there. Even if you don't go to work in a practice setting, there are a couple of issues I think that are really important to keep in mind. First of which is that virtually all of the studies I've done are randomized trials, but it's a harder sell. It's an uphill climb, even in a setting like Kaiser, which is used to a lot of clinical trials going on among the membership. They always kind of come back to us and say, well, isn't there some way you can do this in sort of a sort of study? We don't want to randomize our patients. It's a very painful thing for clinicians very often to feel like that their patient might be missing out on something or might be randomized to whatever control condition, although in most cases, treatment as usual is our control condition here, and this was referred to earlier. Most of our designs are an augmentation design. You know, there's the regular service versus regular service plus some innovative intervention. And I think that actually one can do research with a non-randomized design, and probably the one that works best in a lot of our settings is what's like a multiple baseline staggered rollout, where if you've got, we have about 20 pediatric clinics, and if you were to if you have the ability to collect measurements over time and look as you introduce the new innovative intervention in each clinic over time and you watch the baselines change, you're able to measure what's happening in terms of patient outcomes before you introduce the innovation. I think that's a reasonably convincing, particularly if you see the same pattern from clinic to clinic to clinic, it's a reasonably convincing pattern, and I think it's one that we have to be willing to adopt in certain settings. School districts would be another setting where this kind of design may be more palatable. The other great thing about a lot of this is that it has been very easy for us to move from clinical trials to health services impact, what's the economic cost of the services and the downstream influences on the consumption of other pharmaceutical treatments and other pediatric primary care or mental health specialty care, but also to go back in the system and use the encounter data to say, where are those opportunities for treatment? Where are the kinds of unserved populations or inadequately serve. The ones who, I was just telling Joel about this. Most of you are familiar with the FDA actions on antidepressant medication in late 2004. We were able to very quickly go into our system and look at not only what impacts it have on all dispenses, but what where in the impacts. Was it the initiation of treatment? And in fact, there was very little impact on that. Unfortunately, the impact seemed to be a very dramatic downturn in refills. So that there is a lot of implications that if you want to have some kind of practice improvement research, one would focus not on the initiation identification of new treatments of depression, episodes of depression care, but on the maintenance of care in a lot of these kids, which you would not have all been our assumption if we'd not had access to some of that information. Another thing that's probably important, and again, this is, you know, hindsight is 20/20. As I said, I started out with almost the Cadillac version of interventions in some of our early research. And it was a type of intervention that I don't think, even though it may be clinically effective, it's not very adoptable or disseminable. How many of you have read some of the work by Sonia Schoenwald or John Weiss or Kim Howood on dissemination-oriented treatment development? That may not be the exact name of it, but it's the concept that you start out very often with the concept of what is it going to take, what are the parameters that are going to be acceptable in terms of the adoption of these interventions when you finally get to the point of dissemination. Instead of building the biggest Cadillac to start off with, what are the parameters that are going to be important to policymakers, to purchasers of service, to the deliverers of service, the clinicians that are in the community, to the parents of children, to the children themselves, to the schools if you're working with them. And in fact, it's very important to probably use to partner with qualitative researchers to do what's called formative research, which we've increasingly done. We've developed some internet interventions that are very low intensity. We did a lot of formative research with a lot of these same kind of stakeholders to try to figure out not only usability, can they navigate through the website, but how intense can people stand to have these things? Where is their internet access? Where are they going to be able to use them? What is it going to take to enable these kind of interventions? And one of the models that are out there in terms of making this workable are the step care models, where I've very quickly cobbled together a little pyramid model there, but where the majority of the population may be sufficient to offer them a relatively low intensity intervention. And in part because also patient preferences, even for people with full-blown disorder, the vast majority of a lot of individuals is sort of a wait-and-see kind of a model or of a self-help model, where they're not looking for a highly intensive therapy of the kind one may have been exposed to in your graduate training, where that's reserved perhaps for the individuals who have failed to respond to the lower intensive interventions or maybe came in so severely disordered that you skip over the lower intensity intervention approaches and go right to the high intensity long-duration interventions. But that kind of model in terms of thinking about what's going to be acceptable both economically and in terms of the organization of care is one model I think that's going to have an increasing visibility. It's certainly had a lot of adoption in the adult world. The adult treatment world and the geriatric treatment world has almost no adoption that I'm aware of formally in the pediatric treatment world, but I think it's going to be coming soon. Also, community-based participatory research is an important issue in at least the settings where I've been working. Practice affiliated. By practice affiliated, I mean schools, community clinics, large organized healthcare systems like I work in, and so on. And I mentioned the stakeholder groups that are often convened here. Sometimes those are convened, probably more often they're convened as a means of implementing a particular individual project. But increasingly, there's a lot of benefit to having a longer standing group of this kind that will help shape the research agenda. Now, as I said before, I work in a group where there's only a few psychologists, so it's not necessarily, we're not ourselves capable of addressing all of the issues that the stakeholder groups have identified, violence in youth. We don't have any researchers in our own group that do research or intervention on violence in youth, gangs, shootings, and those kinds of things, which was why one thing that was identified by one of our community stakeholder groups. But it is something that we know is a high priority for those groups, and we want to work to help partner and find other individuals, perhaps in the state of Oregon or Washington that are close by, that do have those areas of expertise and help facilitate the connections to try to meet their needs as well. And I think that part of the issue about getting a lot of your intervention work out into the community is a trust-building exercise. And if you can be selfless in that sense of helping to advance their priorities and what needs to be addressed, what they feel are most compelling for their populations and their communities, then they're more willing to help you in your efforts to disseminate programs that they may not consider to be as high a priority. Meant to be. All right, networks. I'm going to talk about this very, very briefly. How many of you have heard of some of these networks, like the HMO Research Network or the Captain Network? Okay, the RUP. All right. There's always going to be a funding mechanism and a need for smaller scale piloting R34s or 21s, maybe single site R01s, to develop and test preliminary innovative research. There's always going to be the innovations that start on a small scale. But increasingly, a lot of these are going to be moving to larger scale confirmation in pre-existing networks, not necessarily ones initiated by the investigators themselves, who were the ones who initiated the studies. NIMH has its own network called the RUP, Research Unit in Pediatric Pharmacology and Psychotherapy. They're doing a study right now, a multi-site study called TASA, Treatment of Adolescent Suicide Attempters. And it's sort of trying to take the best of what's known out there in terms of pharmacotherapy and psychotherapy and treating suicide attempters. They did some earlier work on secretin and autism and so on. And increasingly, these kind of networks, the CAPTAIN Network is in child psychiatry. John March is the one who organized that, to take the trials out into what they call large, simple trials out in the community, where the assessment battery is relatively small and done it maybe at a centralized coordinating center instead of being done very intensively with a 2 or 3 hour battery at the, which, don't laugh, there are trials I'm working on that have even longer batteries than that. So I think one of the important things as an early career investigator is to be, first of all, be aware that even if you're the originator of a lot of these innovations, eventually you may have to let go or play a secondary role in some senses as these get moved into larger networks. Now, younger scientists, early career scientists are involved, but typically by association with more established scientists. But they are often, and I do know quite a few of them that I supervise, that are being taking over relatively important roles in some of these large national trials. However, there is sort of an approach avoidance issue on these. First of all, it's a lot of hard work, and unfortunately, I think the earlier career investigators get taxed with perhaps more of the thankless jobs, and you aren't necessarily rewarded with first authorship on a lot of these. So I think whatever you do, if you do get invited to be on a network, or if you have an opportunity to seek it out, I would highly recommend it, because it does tend to raise your visibility. It puts you in a working relationship with people who are experts in the field, and that you may get invited in future smaller collaborations. But balance it with your own smaller personal projects that are ones that you have some greater individual stake in. Okay. And I'm trying to zoom through here. How many of you, I wasn't here yesterday, how much did they go over the NIH roadmap? Much at all? Okay. This is my version of the slide. I mean, there's basic bench research. Most of you are probably in the clinical trials efficacy world, perhaps a little bit of shading over to effectiveness research and so on. They call these translation one and translation two. And there is an increasing pressure, although it isn't actually in the direct instructions to the review group so much, but I think it happens more at council, that studies and investigators are being strongly encouraged to stretch themselves out. And if you're an efficacy researcher, to make sure that you've got some link back to the basic science theories and models that underlie this, and if not even just the theories, also some measurement of some of the constructs that will tell you whether or not you've affected the mediational pathways that have been hypothesized to underlie the pathology that you're testing, whether it's depression and so on, or trauma, but also in the other direction, which is what I'm more interested in which the models are not so much basic science models, but models of dissemination, the step care models, one, and so on, or the diffusion, and there is a whole body in medical sociology, a whole body of research about the diffusion of innovations through systems, and so on. One can talk about early adopters and the measurement of barriers to adoption, and so on, that will help guide you in a lot of that kind of research. I think what's important for you in your grants that you write is not so much that you feel that you have to be responsible to have every part of that roadmap represented in your application, but be aware of it. Acknowledge where you lie on that spectrum, and if you can, stretch yourself and your research to tie to some some even early work in terms of translation one or translation two, the underlying mechanisms of the pathology you're studying or trying to treat with. If you are firmly one of those boxes in terms of efficacy research or effectiveness, here's just a couple of things that I may, some I've already mentioned before, adding relevant biomarkers or genetic tests, or design the treatments with ultimate dissemination. Always, I think, if you're doing a clinical trial, make sure you've got some measures of treatment acceptance and social validity to tell you something about whether or not you're going to have difficulty at some subsequent step about getting your treatments adopted. Some of the same kinds of things there. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and stop right there. Thanks very much.